Good morning. Welcome for computer graphics lecture. Today we will speak about transformations. So I already spoke a little bit about transformations when we, I think it even was in the first or rather early in the beginning, I already made a brief introduction to homogeneous coordinates and why they are very convenient. And on Monday, when we spoke about WebGL and GPU-based graphics, we also came back to transformations when we looked into vertex shaders. Yeah, maybe you remember I had that simple example where we were rasterizing a square, and then I've also shown a vertex shader that rotated that square and scaled it a little bit. And in fact, this is the major thing usually that happens in a vertex shader, that is that it transforms the objects that are modeled in some space, in some size, yeah, or in some arbitrary units, and to scale that and to orient it so that it's rendered at the proper position in our window. Yeah, and this all is described by transformations. And later on next week, we will learn that if we have now three-dimensional worlds, yeah, then we have 3D coordinates in our world, and somehow we have to map these to 2D image coordinates. Yeah, and this is essentially what a camera does. It takes our 3D world and it makes a 2D image of that world, and this is what we will describe using also such transformations here. And this is a perspective transformation. This is more complicated than these affine transformations that we did up to now. And this is what we will work towards now. Yeah. And next week, then we will see how does three-dimensional projection, how does perspective work, and how can we describe it also using such matrices. Yeah. And once we know that, we made the step from 2D graphics to 3D graphics. And from then on, we will think in 3D worlds and look at real 3D graphics. Okay, so transformations, yeah? Just a little recap to remember what we already learned. In lecture 2, we were speaking about affine transformations, and we saw which classes of affine transformations we have, like rigid transformations or similarity transformations. We looked at particular transformations like translations, rotations, etc., and at homogeneous coordinates. And today we will learn a little bit more about homogeneous coordinates. We will look at the differences between points and vectors and normals. And we will make a first view, a first introduction to projective transformations. Projective transformations is now a larger class than affine transformations, and in fact it's the set of transformations that we will need to also describe, yeah, perspective, which is a special way of a special type of projective transformations. Okay, so short recap: affine transformations can, or at least for me, they are easiest to understand as a coordinate system change. Yeah, so the idea is that we have an object described in some coordinate system, some local coordinate system in some physical unit, or in some, any unit, inches, meters, kilometers, centimeters, millimeters, whatsoever. And now to bring it on screen, we define a new coordinate system. Yeah, we say, okay, the origin of the object should be at this space on screen, and the object is spawned by two coordinate basis vectors, yeah? And now the coordinates of that object are interpreted as coordinates in that coordinate system here, yeah? And by this we can position an object on the screen by moving the origin, and we can scale the object by scaling the axis, and we can rotate by rotating the axis. And if we take basis vectors, axes that are not perpendicular, we can even skew. Yeah? And this is an affine transformation. And it is described by three vectors, or yeah, we will see there's a difference between points and vectors. So it's described by the origin and by the two basis vectors. Yeah. And this can be described like this here in this form. X and Y are coordinates. Yeah. So these are the original coordinates of that object. And with this mapping, they are transformed now to coordinates on the screen. Yeah. To image coordinates. Last Monday, you learned that, for instance, in OpenGL, coordinates go from -1 to 1. Yeah. And so these vectors here are defined in this coordinate system. And by this, we can position objects on the screen. And yeah, we cannot only describe, or what we can describe with this are all these affine transformations. The most important ones are translations, rotations, scalings, shearings, even reflections. Yeah, can be described this way. Okay, and we also saw that it's, or maybe I could convince you that it's a very elegant way to describe these transformations using homogeneous coordinates. And the idea is that to every point in 2D, we add a third coordinate, which we call the homogeneous coordinate. And for now, we will always set it to 1. And now the idea is that if we have a point described as such homogeneous coordinates, we can describe any affine mapping using such a 3x3 matrix and multiplying that homogeneous point with that matrix. Yeah, so if we have here a point in homogeneous coordinates, and we take this matrix now, let me go back to here. So this mapping here can be described by a matrix that looks like this. This here is the first basis vector, in fact. This is the second basis vector, and this is the translation. And if we do that multiplication with x1, x2, 1, we see directly this vector is multiplied with x1, with the x-coordinate. This is multiplied with a y-coordinate, here called x2. And this one is multiplied with a 1. Yeah, so this is directly added. So in summary, this gives us this here. Yeah, A is this matrix. And this is the translation, yeah? And this is the linear part of our transformation, and this is the translational part. So we can achieve a translation, yeah, by this matrix multiplication, because we use that 1 here to describe the translation. And the resulting vector again has a 1. So it's again a point in homogeneous coordinates. So we can concatenate such transformations, yeah? We can take a matrix that rotates and then translates and then scales and then rotates again, maybe. Yeah, we can describe all these by single matrices. And instead of applying one matrix after another, we can multiply these matrices together to 1. Yeah, so we can concatenate by multiplying the matrices. And in the end, we have multiple transformations multiplied together to a single matrix, and we can quickly apply that one single matrix to points. So if we have a complex object with millions of vertices, yeah, transforming these points in the end always just means one matrix multiplication. Okay, good. So that was the idea, essentially, of homogeneous coordinates. Here again, how does such a matrix then look like? Yeah, so here we have what we call the linear part, because this one is a direct linear multiplication of that matrix with the coordinates x1, x2. Here we have the translation. In the bottom row, for now, we always have 0, 0, 1. Yeah, we will look at other bottom rows today at the end of the lecture. And the linear part, we can also say we can directly interpret that part as the basis vector, or as the two basis vectors, yeah, after the transformation, or that define the transformation, and this one as the translational part. Yeah, so it's rather simple to interpret that matrix directly. Yeah, or to, when we have the matrix given, we can directly say how will the result look like, yeah, because The first row is how the x-axis looks like after the transformation and so forth. Yeah, and this one is directly the translation. Okay, good. So, yeah, homogeneous coordinates are convenient, yeah, because we can do all these concatenations. But in fact, there are many more things with homogeneous coordinates that make it a very elegant tool to describe things. And I won't detail that here in the lecture too much, but there are quite a few things that become very easy if we use homogeneous coordinates. So one thing is that with such coordinates, we cannot only describe points, yeah, but we can use them to describe much more. For instance, also lines in 2D. So let's look at a simple example. Lines in 2D can always be described by such a by such an implicit equation. Maybe you remember for Brasenham, for instance, we described a line also by an implicit equation. Yeah, and if the value of that equation is zero, we are on the line. If it's smaller than zero, we are below. If it's larger than zero, we are above. And these equations always look like this. So a line in 2D, yeah, can be described by these coefficients S, T, and U. Yeah, so that if we write down this equation and set it to zero, then this is true for all points X and Y that are on the line. Okay? And now for every line, obviously S, T, and U, or this implicit equation is the same if we multiply it with an arbitrary value. Yeah? So if we multiply S, T, and U with a 2, the equation is still valid, yeah, because we just multiply the left side with a 2 and the right side is 0. 0 times 2 is 0 again. So obviously S, T, U describe this line as well as 2S, 2T, and 2U. Yeah? They are obviously equivalent. And that maybe reminds you of homogeneous coordinates, yeah? Because in the end, when we do the dehomogenization, yeah, we divide all values by 2u. Yeah? So multiplying with an arbitrary value gives exactly the same point. Yeah? So obviously, this works nicely. Yeah? If we describe or say this point here describes our line, this works in the homogeneous context, yeah, because multiplying with an arbitrary value gives us exactly the same line, yeah, like it is for points. And if we also look at this equation here, we will quickly see we can describe this as a scalar product. We can say this equation is equivalent to multiplying STU with a point XY1. Yeah? If we multiply that out, we get S times X plus T times Y, plus U times 1. Yeah, and if we set this to 0, we have exactly this implicit equation. So obviously a line, yeah, can be interpreted or represented by a point STU in homogeneous coordinates. Yeah, and all points on the line are defined by that the scalar product between that line representation and the point in homogeneous coordinates is zero. Yeah? So we can describe a line also as a point in homogeneous coordinates. So that's a duality, yeah, between points and lines. That's rather convenient. Yeah? So we say, okay, also lines now can be described by homogeneous coordinates. And we can... So that's this here. And we can even generalize that a little bit more and can say the scalar product, so if L is a line, yeah, in this representation, yeah, such a 3D point, the distance of an arbitrary point D to that line is directly the scalar product. Yeah? If the distance is zero, we have points on this line, but more general, we can say, or we can describe the distance using this product here, and in that case we need the right scaling for L to get that, but yeah, it's just to give you a little bit of an idea how that works. Yeah, so we can also use that to compute distances. And we can do that even further. The line through two points, let's say P and Q are two points, and now we want to compute the line equation for the line that goes through these two points. Yeah, surprisingly, this now becomes the cross product between these two points. Yeah, the cross product is the product, maybe you remember, that gives the vector that is perpendicular to two vectors. Yeah. Because now we have inhomogeneous coordinates, we are in 3D, so the cross product is defined. And the 3D cross product of two points now is the equation of the line that goes through these two points. Yeah? I mean, I find that cool. And again, another, yeah, if we have two lines L and M, yeah, now homogeneous points that describe lines, and we compute the cross product between these two, we get the intersection point. Yeah. Okay, you can look that up. There are proofs available, of course, that show that. But yeah, you see, it's really a very, very interesting tool with which we can describe points and lines, yeah, in a dual way. So that if we, yeah, for instance, take the cross product between two points, we get the line through it. And if we take the cross product between two lines, we get the intersection point and so forth. Yeah, so it's rather elegant, and it's used in many applications, also in computer vision, for instance, where we also have to describe very similar things. It usually always works with these homogeneous coordinates. Okay, good. Now, we can play a little bit with that. And one interesting thing that we might want to try now is the following. Let's say we have two lines that are parallel. Yeah? We can describe both of these lines with two homogeneous points. Yeah, and now I told you that we can compute the intersection between these two lines using the cross product. Now, obviously, two parallel lines don't have an intersection point. Yeah, so, but with a cross product, this is always defined. It doesn't have something like division by zero or so. Yeah, so obviously, with this, we can compute an intersection point. Yeah, so is there a contradiction? Yeah, we can make a try. So let's say we have two parallel lines, and in fact, it can quickly be seen that two lines are parallel if the first two coefficients of these lines are the same. Yeah, I won't prove that here, but that's rather simple to show. So two parallel lines might look like this, ABC1 and ABC2. Yeah, so they only differ in C1 and C2. Now, if we compute the intersection point between the two, yeah, between these two, we get this product here, and we see, yeah, because we have homogeneous points, yeah, we can simply divide by C2 minus C1. Yeah, if they are parallel, then parallel but not the same, then C2 minus C1 is not zero, so we can simply divide. This is a zero, so the division doesn't make a difference, and we get this point here. So they have an intersection point, which is surprising. Yeah, where should that be? And maybe you already see what the problem is, or what the idea now is. The homogeneous coordinate now is zero. And what does that mean? Yeah, that's a little bit difficult to interpret, because we said when we have a point x, y, w, yeah, and we want to map that back to 3D, want to do a dehomogenization, yeah, we map it to x over w and y over w, yeah. But now if w is zero, now we have that division by zero thing, yeah. But we can interpret that, because what is x over zero and y over zero? This is something like infinity, yeah. So we can make the following try we look at the limit value. Yeah, so let's say we take W and let it go towards zero and look at this term here. So what we get now, so let's say we have X and Y, let's say are one. Yeah, so X, Y is 1, 1. For W equals 1, the resulting point will exactly be here. Yeah, so this for W equals 1, we get this point here. Yeah, if we make W now smaller and smaller, let's say for W 1/2, we end up here. Yeah, because it's 2x, 2y. And if we make it even smaller, let's say 1/10, yeah, we will be here somewhere at 10x, 10y. Yeah, because by this division, yeah, we move this point always more to the outside, yeah, to infinity. And if we are at infinity, we have a point at infinity in this direction xy. Yeah? If we start with this point, we will end up at a point at infinity in this direction, minus 1, 1. Yeah? So obviously these points with a homogeneous coordinate 0 describe points at infinity, and this fits very well with our parallel lines, yeah? Because now we say, yes, parallel lines do intersect, they intersect at infinity. So by also considering points that have a homogeneous coordinate of 0, we can also describe points at infinity. And this, we will see, is a very convenient thing, and this opens new possibilities. And in fact, what we say, if we have a point with homogeneous coordinate 0, we say, yes, this is valid, but this doesn't describe a point in the world anymore, but it describes a direction. Yeah, it's a point at infinity, yeah, and if we look at that point at infinity, we have a direction. Okay, yeah, so that makes sense, and in fact it brings us to a difference which is often neglected, but it's definitely worth to look at it, and that's a difference between points and vectors. And a vector in our case is the same as a direction. And in fact, it makes perfect sense to look at that difference. And the idea is the following. A point is just a position in space. Yeah, if we are in a 3D world, then we describe the position of a point by coordinates x, y, z. Yeah, that's its world position. Yeah, it's a point in space. And we can define, or points, yeah, are elements of what we call the Euclidean space. Okay, but such points have no real algebraic structure, because if I take this point and I add them, yeah, what does that mean? I can take the coordinates x, y, and z and add these coordinates, and then I get some other point, but the result strictly or strongly depends on where is my origin. Yeah, if I take different spaces, I will always get a different new position. Yeah, so adding points doesn't really make sense for now. Yeah, okay. Or even multiplying with a scalar. Yeah, if I take that point, what is 2 times this point? Yeah, if my origin is here, then it will be here. If the origin is in New York, yeah, then 2 times this point will be somewhere in space. Yeah, so that doesn't really make sense. This is different for vectors. Yeah, a vector is, yeah, what we will later on call a direction. Yeah, or similar to what we will call a direction. And a vector is the difference between 2 points. Yeah, so if I take this point and this point, okay, now we need a third hand. Yeah, but the vector here in between, yeah, or the direction between these two, this is a vector. Yeah, and I can take the difference between that point and that point, or between that point and that point. Yeah. And then I can compute a difference between these two. And this is what we call a vector, not a point, but a vector. And they spawn a different space, the so-called vector space. And on these vectors, I can now make computations. I can take this vector, yeah, and add this vector. And as a result, I get this vector. Yeah. I can take this vector and add this vector. And the result is this vector. Yeah. And so this works. I can also scale them. I can take this vector and scale it by 1/2, and the result is this vector. Yeah, this works. And we can make linear combinations and so forth. Yeah, so often if we compute, if we make computations with 3D points, yeah, with coordinates, very often we compute with vectors and not with points. And yeah, this can be, yeah, if you think about that, yeah, then it will be clear, yeah, that things are rather simple. Yeah, so for instance, if we have two points and we take the difference, then the result is a vector. Yeah, the difference between two points is a vector. This is how we defined vectors. If we take a point or now with a vector, we can add a vector to a point. That works. Yeah. If I take this vector, yeah, and this point, I can add this vector and we get this point. Yeah. So obviously a point plus a vector is a point again. And we can add a vector plus a vector. This gives us a vector and so forth. Yeah. So essentially, if we have a object-oriented programming language, yeah, we can directly say point minus point results in a vector. Yeah, point plus vector gives us a point. Vector plus vector gives us a vector. Scalar times vector gives us a vector. Yeah, scalar times point is undefined. Yeah, gives a type error. And yeah, very often in many libraries, these concepts are mixed. Yeah, so a point and a vector are exactly the same. But other libraries make a distinction. And yeah, so I mainly want to introduce, because I think it's an interesting concept to separate these two things. And in fact, now we can also make a little exception. Yeah, but in fact, it's not really an exception. And this is the following. So remember barycentric coordinates? When we were speaking about triangles, we said, okay, we have a triangle with vertices A, B, C. Yeah. So these are obviously points. Yeah. So a triangle lives in space and its vertices are points in 3D space. Yeah. It's not vectors. The edges are vectors. This is a vector. Yeah. And this is a vector. Okay, but when we make barycentric coordinates, we make multiplications. Yeah, we have now alpha, beta, gamma. These are scalars. And now we obviously take a scalar value times A plus a scalar value times B plus a scalar value times C. Yeah, so this contradicts a little bit to what we've seen here. But in fact, when I introduced barycentric coordinates, I told you that the normal way to do that would be that we say that this triangle is spawned by this vector and by this vector. Yeah, so we describe it in this way: A plus beta times B minus A plus gamma times C minus A. Yeah. And so if we resort that, we get 1 minus beta minus gamma times A plus beta times B plus gamma times C. And this one we called alpha. Yeah, and now we are exactly at that formula here. Yeah. And this one here, this is valid because this is a vector. This is a vector. vector plus vector is vector, and point plus vector is a point. Yeah. So if we write it this way, then it's valid in that respect. Yeah. And this is just a resorting, yeah, a special, a more convenient way to write it down. But in fact, it's a valid operation, and it's only valid because alpha plus beta plus gamma in this case are one. Yeah. And this is a special case here. Now we say, using such a barycentric combination here, yeah, is a special operation that is valid. Yeah, so we can take three points or an arbitrary number of points and make a linear combination of these with weights that sum up to one. And then the result again is a point. Yeah, so that's a barycentric combination. And this is valid. Yeah, so it's a kind of, now we have some algebraic structure. Yeah, we can make such a barycentric or an affine combination. Yeah, so this is valid. This is a valid operation on two points. A simple variant of that is that we say, okay, two points and just take the midpoint between the two. Yeah, this is a very simple, if this is P and Q, then the midpoint is 1/2 P plus 1/2 Q. Yeah. So this is valid because we can also describe it as P plus 1/2 Q minus P. Okay. And in fact, there's even another thing. We can also make a generalized difference. And this is also such a combination. But here now the weights sum to zero. And this is what we call a generalized difference. And this is also an allowed operation because if we do that for a number of points, we get as a result a vector. And the most simple example is we take the two vectors, A and B, and we take minus 1 times A plus 1 times B, and this is exactly B minus 1. This is the difference, and the difference between two points is a vector, but we can do that more general. And then we have the generalized difference. Yeah? Okay. So, I mean, that's for the beginning. That's not too important, but maybe some of you like that, yeah, because it really shows that things play together very nicely. And as a result, yeah, for us, what that means, if we take homogeneous coordinates, yeah, we can simply describe, or what usually works, yeah, is that we simply say a point is described this way, yeah, and a vector is described this way. And that again works, yeah, if we say I have a point x, y, or a1, a2, 1, and a point B1, B2, 1. Yeah, these are points because they have a 1 in the bottom. And if we take the difference, the homogeneous coordinates now become 0. Yeah, and now we automatically have that. Point minus point gives a vector. Yeah, and all that stuff that I've described before will work out. Yeah, if you make, even here, if you make a barycentric combination, yeah, if your weights sum up to 1 and you plug in all points with a 1 in the bottom, the resulting point will also have a 1, so it will be a point. And if it sums up to 0, then you will get a 0 at the bottom, yeah, and everything automatically happens. Okay, good. Yeah, but now the let's look at a practical implication. So let's say we make an affine transformation of points. Yeah, so we have an affine mapping like this here, and we apply that to points. So we have here our shape, and we transform it. Yeah, you've seen the image very often. Yeah, and this is how points are transformed. Yeah, a point is transformed this way. But now let's look at vectors. Yeah, so let's look at this vector here that goes from the tip to this point here. Yeah, this vector, if we transform that, it results in this vector. But obviously, when doing the transformation from here to here, yeah, or when we want to compute that transformed vector, not transformed point, yeah, we have to ignore this translation. Why? If we look at that vector, we say V is B minus A. And now let's transform B and A. So we take AB plus T minus AA plus T. So this is the transformation of B. This is the transformation of A. And if we take this difference, then this T cancels out, plus T minus T. And so as a result, if we want to transform a vector, we only should apply A, but not the translation. Yeah. And so transforming vectors is different from transforming points. But if we take again these homogeneous coordinates, this automatically happens because if we take as vector x1, 0, this 0 is multiplied with a translation in the matrix and we automatically get the right result again. Yeah? Again, things work nicely together. Okay. Good. So, as I said, this is a little bit, it's practically, essentially it means, write a 0 if you have a vector, write a 1 if you have a point, and then many things automatically happen. Of course, sometimes you will see a surprise anyhow and have to rethink. But many things really work nicely. And now there will be one interesting exception. So, or let's put it the other way around. What are interesting vectors in computer graphics? So because up to now we said our triangles, they have vertices. And if we want to position them on our canvas, we will simply transform the vertices as points. So why is a vector maybe interesting? Vectors will become interesting, for instance, if we go to 3D and we want to describe light. So we say we have a 3D scene and the scene is illuminated by sunlight. Then typically we have to say, where is the sun? And the sun, the direction can be described by a vector. It's a direction. In this direction, we assume it's at infinity. And in this direction, from this direction, sunlight is coming. So the light direction will be described as a vector. And if we now transform our scene, we have to transform the direction to the sun like this and points also like this. But we need to make that difference between points and vectors. Okay. And then later on, there will be another very important vector that we will have very often, and this is the so-called normal. We will come back to that later, but let me here briefly already describe, because it also interacts in this context. So the normal vector is a vector that is perpendicular on a surface, or in this example, if we are in 2D, it's perpendicular on an edge. It's a vector that describes the orientation of a surface. So for this table, this would be the normal vector. And it describes the orientation of that surface. And for the blackboard, it would be this normal vector. And if you have something curved, then the normal vector varies like this. And we need that normal vector to do lighting computations. Because the color of a surface point depends on how it is oriented with respect to a light source. So we will need that very often. So in that example, we have a rectangle, and here you see the normal vectors on these four sides. And now the interesting question is, the normal vector, as the name says, is a vector. But is it also be transformed? If we now take our object and rotate it and scale it and so on, we want to have the normal vectors after the transformation. So if we describe the normal vector like here, just with a 0 and do the transformation, do we get the right result? And unfortunately, we won't. So let's say this is our surface, or our object. And now we do here such a sharing, then the resulting vector, if we do it like described before, we will get this vector here. But this is no longer a normal vector. So you will see also here, this vector is shared like this edge here, But in fact, the normal vector remains unchanged. Yeah, the surface doesn't change its orientation. This one, an unchanged normal vector, would be the right one. This is a little bit tricky. And in fact, it will result in effect later on that when we do lighting computations, we have to transform normals with another matrix like points and vectors. Yeah, and we will have to apply a special matrix for normal vectors. And the right answer can be quickly derived. The idea is essentially the following. In that case, the normal vector changes not as we wish. But if we look at the tangent vector here, we will see that the tangent vector, or if we consider the tangent vector as a normal vector and we apply that transformation, then this is fine. The tangent vector is transformed correctly. So what we can simply say is that the normal vector should always be perpendicular to the tangent vector, yeah? And then we apply the transformation to the tangent vector, and we can do that in the following form. Yeah, we simply say what we want is that the normal vector and the tangent vector are perpendicular, and then we apply our matrix A to the tangent vector, with some equations. I think I should skip that for time reasons, but it's also not important. This derivation, but the result is that the matrix with which we have to transform the normal vector is this one. This is the matrix A inversed and transposed. And if you're a little bit familiar with linear algebra, maybe you know that if we have an orthogonal matrix, that means a matrix where the basis vectors are perpendicular and normalized, yeah? In that case, inversion and transpose is the same. So A minus T is A again. Yeah, so if we have orthonormal matrix A, then these matrices are identical. Yeah, A and A minus T are the same. But as soon as we have something like a sharing, then we need to compute that matrix as normal matrix. So in the general case, yeah, for normals, we have to compute an extra matrix like this here and use that to transform normals. Okay, good. Yeah, so as a result, yeah, if we have homogeneous coordinates, we can use them to describe points with a 1 as last component. We can describe vectors with a 0 at last component. We can apply transformations to normal points and vectors, yeah, simply by multiplying them together with the matrices. The differences between points and vectors are automatically made. But if we have normals, we have to take care that we take another matrix. Yeah? Okay, that's essentially the summary of what I told you up to now. Yeah, but now we have a very convenient way to describe all geometric things, yeah, points, vectors, all this in a very uniform setup. Okay. Now let's try and extend that a little bit. Yeah. So you see affine transformations, yeah, they are very convenient, and it's a very important class of transformations. And they have a number of properties, yeah, that can essentially directly be derived from the fact that affine is just a change of coordinate system. So one important property is that it maps lines to lines. That means if we have a line, after any affine transformation, this line is still a line. Yeah, it doesn't do something weird that it maps it to a curve or something like that. Lines are mapped to lines. Parallel lines remain parallel. Yeah, this can also quickly be seen and also shown and probably also be computed using these nice descriptions of lines that we saw before. Division ratios are preserved. And there comes here an image what that means. Two parallel lines after this transformation remain parallel. If they are mapped to something like this, yeah, this is not affine. An affine transformation always maps parallel lines to parallel lines. And ratios are preserved. That simply means that if we take two points and their midpoint, yeah, then the midpoint is again mapped to the midpoint of these two. Yeah, so if we have two points or a line and we map it, yeah, then the image of the midpoint is also the midpoint of this line here. Yeah, can also be shown easily. And in fact, these two properties, yeah, won't be true anymore if we apply perspective. We will see that in a minute. Okay, so division ratios are preserved, parallel lines remain parallel, angles are not preserved. Yeah, if we have a sharing, then such a square is mapped to something like this, and here this is these are perpendicular, and here they are not any longer. Yeah, so angles are not preserved. Okay, these are affine transformations. Yeah, and up to now we were only looking at 2D transformations, but in fact all this immediately transfers to 3D. Yeah, our matrices become a little bit bigger. Yeah, instead of two axes, now we have three axes in space. So we have X, Y, and Z. So in fact, we have to define that now by an origin and three vectors, all in 3D, so our matrix will look like this. We have three basis vectors now and a 3D origin. Yeah, so now we have these 12 values that define our affine mapping, but otherwise everything is exactly the same. Yeah, we have again homogeneous coordinates. We will set this coordinate to 1. We can make the differentiation between points and vectors using a 0 as homogeneous coordinate. Everything works exactly like before. Yeah, and also an interesting property, also this exactly works in 2D the same way. We can, by using the inverse matrix, yeah, we can get exactly the inverse mapping. So we can say if we have an arbitrary such shape, which is called a parallel epiped, and we have a point and we want to compute the coordinates of that point with respect to this one here. Essentially, that means we map this parallel epiped to a cube. We can simply do that. Yeah, we can describe this direction, we can describe easily, and by taking the inverse, we can go the other way. Yeah, so this is a very convenient way by matrix inversion, yeah, to reverse a mapping, and sometimes we need the mapping in the other direction, and we can simply do that by a matrix computation. And at this point, it's also worth to note, and at some places we will need that, and for the normal part, we already used that. An interesting thing is that if our basis vectors E1, E2, and E3 are orthonormal, that means they all have length 1 and they all are perpendicular. This is what we called, by the way, the transformations are rigid transformations. Yeah, if these three vectors are only rotated but not scaled or shared or so, they are only rotated. Yeah. If this is the case, then the inverse is simply the same as a transposed. Yeah, so we can simply take this matrix here. We call that R because it's a rotation matrix. Yeah, if the vectors are orthonormal, then it describes a rotation. And if this is the case, we can simply invert it by computing the transpose. Yeah, from time to time we will need that, and it's rather convenient. For the translational part, yeah, this can be computed like that. This can also be shown easily. Yeah, but inversion, if we know that we only have a Richard transformation, then the inversion is very simple. Okay. A little, yeah, thing to take care of at this point. Here, mathematicians chose a slightly different notation. Yeah, so a matrix with orthonormal rows. That means, yeah, such a rigid transformation where there's no scaling. Yeah, this is by mathematicians, they call it orthogonal. Yeah, orthogonal essentially means would also allow a scaling. Yeah. But for some reason, mathematicians call such a matrix not orthonormal, but orthogonal. And orthogonal, in our sense, that also a scaling can be around allowed, doesn't have a real name in for mathematicians. They just call it matrix. Yeah. I inserted that slide because from time to time we have mathematicians here. Is there a mathematician here? Or somebody studying math? No? Okay. And they were seriously confused, so I added that slide here. Okay, good. So, as I said, in 3D, everything works like in 2D. Our translation matrix now looks like this. We have a three-dimensional translation, a scaling. We need now three scaling coefficients. And the sharing is a little bit also different because now we don't have a if we share in X, we do not only have one single value that describes the sharing, but a two-dimensional direction. Yeah, so we can make the sharing now in X and Y, so we have two sharing parameters if we share in Z direction in that example. Yeah, but otherwise, yeah, I mean, things are very simple. There's one big exception, and that's rotation. Yeah. In 2D, rotation is very simple because there's only one axis around which we can rotate. Yeah, if we have the 2D plane, X and Y, and we have this point, yeah, and we rotate around the origin, yeah, then we can only rotate around an axis, yeah, which here goes out of the blackboard. Yeah, essentially the third Z coordinate. That's the only reasonable axis which we can rotate around. But in 3D, yeah, we have many axes. Yeah, it's much more complicated to describe a rotation in 3D using angles. Yeah. Because yeah, we can choose an arbitrary rotation axis. And so what we could do, the simple way to describe a rotation in 3D would be that we say, okay, let's rotate around the main axis. Yeah, we can describe a rotation around the x-axis. And that means, yeah, if this is our coordinate system, x, y, z, we can rotate around this axis. So only y and z changes and x remains constant. So in this matrix, we can see, because here we have 1, 0, 0, 0, x remains constant, and y and z change, and in fact, yeah, this here is this sub-matrix here describes the 2D rotation, and if we rotate around x in the y-z plane, that's a standard rotation, yeah? And the same if we rotate around z, it's exactly that's what we've seen here. Yeah, this is the z-axis, and if we rotate around z, it's a rotation in the 2D plane spawned by x and y. So this is the matrix that describes the 2D rotation around z. Yeah, changes x and y, and if we rotate around y, we have this axis for x and z. Yeah, so this is just describing lifting that idea from 2D to 3D. So we can describe at least the rotations around X, Y, and Z. But yeah, what if we have a rotation now around the diagonal or around an arbitrary vector? And yeah, so how can we describe that? And in fact, this is a really difficult, surprisingly difficult problem. And it's a problem that forces, for instance, game developer suddenly to handle complicated algebraic spaces. Yeah, and we will see in the very in the end, yeah, that probably the best way to describe rotations, that means is at first sight a rather complicated idea, yeah, and maybe more complicated than you thought. So why do we need these rotations, by the way? Yeah, so why is it so important? The reason is very simple. So let's say I have an object like this one here, yeah, and I made a 3D model of that object. Yeah, so I have coordinates in some local coordinate system, and now I want to position that object in space. Yeah, and I want to move it. Let's say it's an airplane, yeah, or a rocket or something like that. Then of course I do not only want to be able to translate it, yeah, but also to put it into an arbitrary pose, yeah, so that it can fly like this, for instance. Yeah, and now to describe that position in space, yeah, to position it at an arbitrary orientation somewhere in space, I need a rotation. Yeah, I need to put it somewhere in an arbitrary pose, and that mapping from its original coordinate system to an arbitrary pose is a rotation. That means to be able to position that, yeah, I need a way to describe that rotation. And the simplest way to do that, maybe, is that we say, okay, our matrices are just, yeah, coordinate system changes. So I can take my original coordinate system, yeah, and describe the mapping by a matrix where these columns here, yeah, are just the rotated basis vectors. That's what we always used. Yeah. And now we have our matrices, or have a matrix, and these vectors need to be orthonormal, all have length 1 and be perpendicular one with each other, and then we know it's a rotation. Okay, that works nicely, and as we learned before, in our case here, we can even compute the inverse very easily if we know that this is the case, because then the inverse is the transpose. Now, what's the interesting problem? Now, or why is there a problem remaining? Okay, now there's a very simple problem, and that's the following. Let's say, and very often we will have the problem, let's say we want to animate an object. Yeah, and we say, okay, we start in this pose, yeah, and in the end we want to be in this pose, so we somehow want to interpolate, yeah, and want to move the object from here to here, yeah, and do an animation. This is what we call, we want to interpolate these rotations. And, somehow these slides have been swapped. Okay, so now what's the problem if we do an interpolation and have rotation matrices? Yeah, so we have a matrix that describes this pose, and we have a matrix that describes this pose, and now we want to animate the object so that it goes from here to here. Yeah, and we take that matrix and that matrix, and the easiest way to interpolate now is to interpolate these matrices. Yeah, so a special case of interpolation would be that we choose the midpoint. Yeah, so we take that matrix and just compute the average, yeah, the midpoint between these two matrices. Yeah, we take every coefficient and just take the midpoint, or interpolate from the starting value to the end value. So this somehow works, but the result is not very good. And the reason is, yeah, so or the reason, what will happen is the following. So let's assume we want to interpolate from this position to this position. What will not happen is that the object moves like this, but what will happen is that the object on its way here will shrink. Here it will be rather small, and then it will go to this pose and become bigger again. And this looks very awkward. Yeah? So it's not a normal thing that objects, yeah, just by moving from here to here, shrink in between. And the reason is the following. I mean, that's rather simple to see. The entries of the matrix here are vectors, essentially. And what we do if we interpolate these matrices, we interpolate these vectors. And if we take, well, it fits somewhere here. If we take this vector, yeah, so let's say this is the first basis vector in the beginning, yeah, E1, and this is the E1 in the end, yeah, so let's say this is at time 0 and this is at time 1, then in between a linear interpolation generates these vectors. So in between, yeah, this will be one interpolated basis vector, and obviously it doesn't have length 1 anymore. Yeah, this has length 1. This has length 1, but here we have length 0.3, for instance. Yeah? And by this, the object here in between will shrink. Yeah? So it doesn't really move on a circle. This is what we would expect. Yeah? But instead, it moves linearly, and so in between, it will just become smaller. So, oh, sorry, that's the wrong slide. Yeah, this is what we see here. Yeah, we have a basis vector, and then the rotated version. Yeah. And in between, these basis vectors become these linearly interpolated linear interpolations, and they then become smaller. Yeah? If we only have a very slight movement, that won't be visible, but if the rotation angle is larger, then we will see that. Okay, yeah, so that's not a very nice property, yeah? But how can we do these interpolations now smarter? Some might say, okay, why not simply do the interpolation and simply renormalize the vectors in between? Yeah, so when we see, okay, this vector here is too small, we can simply increase its length, yeah, again to 1. So we can take the interpolated matrix and renormalize the vectors in between. This somehow would work, but the result is that we don't get a uniform movement. Yeah, the object will start slowly, and then, no, sorry, it will start quickly, in between become slower, and then become faster again in the end. Now the rotation also looks unnatural. Okay, good. Yeah, so that's the disadvantage of using matrices. Another alternative to describe rotations are so-called Euler angles. And Euler angles, here the idea is the following. It can be shown that any rotation of an object can be described using three angles. Yeah, so essentially, to describe a rotation in 3D, we have 3 degrees of freedom. Yeah, in 2D, we have one rotation angle. In 3D, we will need 3 angles, and we can describe any rotation of an object by 3 rotations about the main axis. That means we can first rotate around the x-axis, then around y, and then around z. Yeah? So any rotation can be decomposed in first a rotation around x, then y, and then z. And in fact, this can be extended. Of course, it cannot be only around x, y, and z, but also, for instance, around x, z, and then y. Or maybe we can include the diagonal. Yeah, we can take 3 arbitrary axes and can describe any rotation by 3 successive such rotations. And in fact, we can even use 1 axis twice, like in that example. We can first rotate around z, then around y, and then once again around z. Yeah, so we have many ways, but we always need 3 angles. And these 3 angles are then called Euler angles. And with Euler angles, you always also always have to say what are the corresponding axes. So in that case, yeah, we have z, y, z, and any rotation now can be described by such angles. Or for any rotation, we can find such angles that we can describe the rotation using that way. And for the z-y-z example, if we multiply that out, we get that horrible form here, yeah, which is, yeah, not very, very nice, but it's a very compact way to describe rotations. And in fact, this is also a typical way, maybe some of you are whatever, playing plane simulators or something like that. Yeah, if you navigate a plane and you want to describe the orientation of a plane in space, they typically use three angles, such Euler angles. Yeah, the first one is the direction the plane is flying. Yeah, north, east, south, west, or whatsoever. That's a rotation around the normal of the Earth, in some sense. Yeah. More difficult if we are on the sphere, but if we just have a plane, yeah, then we have a rotation around this. The next one is pitch. That means whether the nose goes up or down. Yeah. So you can fly in a certain direction, then go up or down. That's the second angle. It's a rotation around the local x-axis of the object. And in the end, you have roll. That's the orientation. Yeah. Like, like this. Yeah. The roll angle. And in fact, these are exactly Euler angles. Yeah. It's all axis local to the plane. And with this, you can describe arbitrary orientations of your plane. Okay. Good. And yeah, this is, how a try to illustrate the effects, yeah, of these angles. So first of all, we have our original coordinate system here shown in blue. Then first of all, we rotate around the z-axis. That's this here. Yeah, then the x-axis shows into this direction. Then we rotate around around x. The x-axis is this one here now. Then we rotate, and by this blue disk here becomes this red disk, and in the end, yeah, this is this beta. And then we rotate around z again, and we end up here in this coordinate system x, y, z. And here you see the three Euler angles, yeah, between these. And looking at this image, it is even possible to derive, if we have an arbitrary matrix, to derive these angles, alpha, beta, and gamma, yeah, by looking at special entries. So this entry here essentially defines beta and so forth. Yeah. I tried it twice to explain how we come from here to here and always failed. So I better leave it for now. But it's at least it's possible, yeah, to look at the matrix and to get back the Euler angles. And going from the Euler angles to the matrix is very simple. Yeah, we just take these basis matrices, yeah, for the rotation around x and y and z. Yeah, here we have these, and we just have to multiply these matrices together for these given Euler angles. Okay, so that seems to be very convenient, yeah. It also has an advantage that for any angles, we will always get a real rotation, so that shrinking problem during animation obviously cannot exist, yeah, because for every angles we provide, we will get a valid rotation matrix, yeah, with no scalings or whatever involved. Yeah, and it's rather intuitive, yeah. Think about the plane example, yeah. So if you write a flight simulator, yeah, this is probably exactly the way you would describe the position of a plane. Yeah, but Euler angles are probably even worse than matrices, and they have a problem which is called the gimbal lock problem. And the gimbal lock problem is, there is a nice video here. We can have a look at it. If I get a connection. Okay. Oops. Okay. This is, yeah. Euler rotations explained. Okay. So yeah, blah, blah. So maybe some of you have already seen something like this. Such gimbals are also used for sometimes for cameras, so that they can, that you can fix it to whatever, for instance, a drone, yeah, so that it always maintains its direction independent of movements of the drone. And essentially, they work like this. So this is the object that we want to rotate, and they are now here. Part of such a, and this is what is called a gimbal, yeah? And you see it has three axes. So first of all, it can rotate within this inner ring around this axis. This ring here can rotate within this bluish ring can rotate within this more reddish ring, and this one can rotate within the greenish ring, yeah? So we have three angles. And now we can bring the object in the center into an arbitrary position, yeah? And the rotations of each of these three axes, these are exactly the Euler angles. Yeah? So that's a direct physical model for Euler angles with rotations x, y, and z. Yeah? And so it directly helps maybe a little bit to understand. So we can rotate in this direction, we can rotate in this direction, and we can rotate in this direction. And in fact, these are exactly the angles for the plane I told you. Yeah, direction, pitch and roll. Okay? Good. So, that looks cool. Yeah? And we can now rotate in arbitrary directions and whatsoever. But there's this one problem. If we rotate in this direction, so now two axes coincide. Yeah? And okay, let me, it goes further. So maybe you should also watch it at home with a text explained. Yeah, here we see the three axes. Yeah, it's y, x, and z. This is the direction. And now we can rotate in arbitrary directions. Yeah, and we can say, first of all, they are sort of hierarchical, because first we apply green, then we red, apply red, and then blue. Probably that with text from the speaker would be better. Yeah, okay. Okay, here we I think have the gimbal lock. Yeah, and now we can describe arbitrary motions. Yeah, using these vectors, using these Euler angles, and this is rather lengthy. And we will always run into problems as soon if we have something like a 90-degree rotation in one of these, because then suddenly the rotation axis coincide and we get locked into situations where we can only get out by rotating an early one back and then a later one forward. It's not simple to describe. Look at that video. And so here this is such a gimbal lock position. And for all combinations, we can get into such a situation where suddenly we are locked. And cannot do a proper animation anymore. And this is an ugly problem. Okay, on my screen it looks wrong. Wow. You try. Okay. Wow. Okay. And maybe there's a way to describe that using the plane analogy. So let's assume you want to make a looping with your plane. Yeah. So what happens? Yeah. So let's say orientation is always this direction. this is not important. But now you start the looping. That means you take your pitch angle and you go upwards. Yeah. And at some point, you're in that position. Yeah. If you want to describe, or let's say you want to interpolate from here to here. Yeah. So at that moment, when you are in that position, an alternative way to describe it is the following. You rotate, you fly in the opposite direction and go upward and roll. Then you end up at exactly the same position. Yeah. And if you do your animation from here to here, it might happen that it doesn't do this, but that it does this. It changes this direction, it rolls, and it changes the pitch. Yeah. So it's a very awkward way. Yeah. For a human, it's obvious what the best interpolation from here to here is. Yeah. But using Euler angles, it will end up in something like this. Yeah. And this is a surprising effect. Yeah. You make small interpolations and your object makes very weird movements. And it's also an instance of that gimbal lock problem. Yeah. Because at that point, axes are aligned and you're in that gimbal lock state. Yeah. And you have to get over that state, and Euler angles make weird decisions to get out of that locked state. Okay. So Euler angles seem to be elegant, but absolutely useless for describing rotations in some sense, yeah, due to that problem. A more elegant way is the following. It can also be shown that an arbitrary rotation of an object can always be described by a single rotation around an arbitrary axis, yeah? So in Euler angles, we say we rotate around X, Y, and Z, yeah, and this gives us three angles, so we can reach every state. Here the idea is that we only make one rotation, but we rotate around an arbitrary axis. Yeah, so we say we specify the rotation by an axis, N, yeah, and a rotation angle. Okay, and this can also be used to describe an arbitrary rotation. And we can also, with some math, describe the corresponding matrix. Yeah. I again have the math here. So, yeah, take a look at it. I mean, it's not very complicated to describe that. In the end, we will look up formulas on a web page anyhow. Yeah. But in the end, it can be described using two simple matrices. This is the outer product of a normal with itself. This is a matrix that describes the cross product of a normal and a point. And with these matrices, we can then quickly write down this matrix R. Yeah. And here omega is the rotation angle. This is this outer product, and Q is this Q matrix. Yeah. So this can be rather easily transformed into a matrix. Yeah. Okay, good. So why does that help us? Yeah, so this is something we can interpolate nicely. So let's say we have an object, or we have a rotation that is described by a rotation axis and an angle, and we have another rotation described by another axis and another angle. And now to interpolate, we simply interpolate the rotation axis and the angles. And this gives a very smooth transition. This will give exactly what we expect. Yeah. So for the airplane example, going from here to here will simply be this. Yeah. This will give exactly what a human would also expect from interpolation. This is a big advantage. Also you see here the math is a little bit involved. Yeah, you can compute back and forward. In fact, it's also possible from a matrix to compute back the axis and angle. It's mathematically more involved. And in fact, it is most often not used because there's an alternative that does something very similar, but in a more abstract way, which is in the end practically rather simple to use, but difficult or more difficult to explain. Okay, and these are quaternions. Quaternions are definitely the best way to describe rotations. And they are also definitely the by far most abstract way to describe rotations, but they are abstract way that can be interpolated easily. It's very compact, it's very simple to compute with them, and in every computer game, or in probably 99% of the computer games that where you have 3D objects flying around, their position will be described by quaternions. Yeah, because they're just, from a practical point of view, have so many advantages. But it's also very abstract. Yeah, but let me describe the idea. Yeah, I mean, we could make a complete lecture probably about quaternions, but for our purpose, a short introduction is just enough, and that you know how to use them. The idea of quaternions is the following. Probably you know complex numbers. I hope you do. And the idea of complex numbers is that we simply have numbers with two components. Yeah, we can also interpret them as points on the plane, 2D points. Okay, and we describe them usually by saying x plus I times y, and I is the square root of minus one. Yeah, it's this imaginary number. And we write down these numbers typically in this way, and we say this is the real part and this is the imaginary part. And probably you remember that we can, on these complex numbers, we can do additions and so on. Yeah, we can compute, make computations with them like with normal real numbers. And there's one interesting observation, and that is that a multiplication with complex numbers corresponds to a rotation. That means if we have a 2D point, this here, yeah, and so this is a point, this way, x plus I times y, and we multiply that point now by an imaginary number. Let's say now I have to be careful that I don't tell you nonsense. We multiply it by a unit vector with this angle here, then the multiplication results in a rotation. So this vector here describes a rotation by this angle. So if we multiply this number with this number, we rotate this point by this angle. So we can describe a rotation, or a multiplication corresponds to a rotation in 2D. Yeah? And the imaginary part is the rotation angle. But the direction here encodes the rotation angle. Okay, good. So that's complex numbers, and in fact, it is possible to define something similar for higher dimensions. And these are quaternions. Quaternions are now complex numbers, but they don't have one imaginary part, but three imaginary components. Yeah. So, or we could also say it has a three-dimensional imaginary part, or we have three imaginary components, I1, I2, and I3. Yeah, so a quaternion is a 4D vector, a real part, and three imaginary parts. And I mean, I don't know the history behind that, but yeah, of course, it's the typical thing that mathematicians like. They say, oh, complex numbers were cool. Yeah, why not use another imaginary part? And why not use three imaginary parts? And it is possible also to define all the typical math operations using these quaternions. So we can add them, for instance. And here now in this description, A and B, A is always the real part, and B is the second is the imaginary part, and this is a 3D vector. Yeah, so the imaginary part now is a three-dimensional vector. So Yeah, this is a quaternion. This is a one-dimensional, this is a scalar, and this is a 3D vector. And we can simply add them by adding the real parts and the imaginary parts. So that's simple. We can multiply with a scalar by simply multiplying that scalar into that vector. And we can define a multiplication, but that one becomes more complicated now. Yeah, this is really not what you would probably, after 1 minute of thinking, come up with. But using this definition, it can be shown this is a valid product, and we can use it to really compute also with these quaternions. And we can also define a scalar product that looks like this. Yeah, so the product of the imaginary parts plus the scalar product of the product of the real parts plus the scalar product of the imaginary parts. And we can define conjugates, we can define a norm, and can also inverse quaternions, so compute the reciprocal. Okay, so this is an algebraic structure, completely abstract, and the nice thing now is that people found out that these quaternions, like these describe rotations in 2D, quaternions can describe rotations in 3D. And now it's a little bit more complicated. It's not just a simple multiplication like here, but if we have such, let's say we have such a quaternion Q. It's a 4D vector. Remember, rotations are 3D. Now we need a 4D vector. That's a little bit suspicious, but we can solve that quickly. So we have an arbitrary quaternion. Now we take a vector that we want to rotate. We want to rotate a vector. And we describe that vector also as a quaternion here. So we take the vector as the imaginary part, and the real part is set to 0. The imaginary part is a 3D vector. So we simply transform a vector to a quaternion by taking that vector as the imaginary part. And then we multiply, or we apply this formula here. So we take this vector, multiply it with Q, and then multiply the result with the inverse of Q. And the result will again have a real part 0, and the imaginary part now is a rotated variant of the original V. Don't ask me why, but it is the case. So if we take such a vector, transform it to a quaternion, apply this formula, we will get again such a vector with a 0 in the beginning, and this V here is a rotated vector. So we can rotate a vector by transforming it like this, applying these quaternions, and then we get a rotated vector. Now the question is, which rotation? How can we describe the rotation that is given by Q? And there's one other thing. We can now simply concatenate multiple rotations. So let's say we have a rotation Q and R. So if we rotate V, we take this product. That's a simplified. I left out that zero part. So if we apply Q, we get this. If we additionally apply R, we get this here. And now by using brackets, we will see that this the concatenation of two rotations is just the product of these two quaternions. So we can concatenate quaternions by simply multiplying that. Concatenation is multiplication. That's very convenient. And we can also probably not find out, but read it up somewhere on a web page, that such a quaternion or a rotation around an axis n by an angle omega, you remember that's exactly this representation that we had here. An arbitrary rotation around an arbitrary axis and an angle. This rotation can be described by this quaternion here. So that's worth a brief look. So the real component is the cosine of the rotation angle halved, Yeah, so somehow the rotation angle is coded in the real part, and the imaginary part has the rotation axis times this sign here. So it's a scaled version of the axis. So the rotation axis is the imaginary part, and the rotation angle is the real part. Yeah, and this is very similar to what we had here. Yeah, there was also the imaginary part described the rotation and so forth. Yeah, so yeah, it's a very convenient way now. Yeah, we have an arbitrary rotation. We describe it using a normal and an angle and can convert it to such a quaternion. Yeah, and now the typical way to describe rotations is that we use such quaternions. And we can now do simple computations with our quaternions. We can multiply them to describe a concatenation. And the nice thing is we can also interpolate them very easily. And it will always result in a very intuitive way. Yeah, it always generates sort of the shortest path to get from this pose to this pose. Yeah, and not something weird in between. It will always give us something very smooth. Okay, and as somehow expected, I didn't manage to do all the stuff on this slide set, but we will continue that then next week. And we will also continue next week then how we now get beyond affine matrices by not only looking at affine, but also look at the bottom row of our matrices and how we get to a new class, new larger class of transformations that we will then also use to describe perspective. Okay, but all that happens next week, and we will see you again on Monday. Thank you.